You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
This tour started in London at BP's annual shareholder meeting and continued all across the United States and now wrapping up in Canada. And it's a particularly important time to be talking about offshore oil drilling in Canada, which Ben will talk about more. But basically Chevron, a company I work on extensively, is one of several companies that is doing exploratory deep offshore, looking at deep offshore drilling in the Canadian Arctic and has an exploratory license to start poking its nose around, which is something you should all be very worried about. And I don't have to talk about too much because I am editor of this, the third annual alternative annual report for Chevron. And this is a report that is the voices of communities impacted by Chevron writing about what it means to live in a community where Chevron operates. And there's a really wonderful piece by Andrea, I'm forgetting Andrea's last name, Cardin of the Council of Canadians, writing about Chevron's exploration activities in the Beaufort Sea. But also, if you want to know what the potential for those operations are, you can read about Chevron's current offshore operations in this report in the Gulf of Mexico, in Alaska, in Angola, in Nigeria, all around the world from communities already experiencing those operations if you want to know what you will face were they to come to your neck of the woods. So you don't have to imagine what it would be. You can read about it right here. I have a couple of hard copies, but the report is also available at truecostofchevron.com. You can read it online, and you can also download it there. The nature of my work has been for some time looking at communities directly impacted by oil's operations and trying to expose the reality of those operations, raise the voices of impacted communities, and try to help organize for as long as we are dependent on oil, which I believe we currently are, to better rein in, restrict, regulate, act as the parent to oil, which we currently do not. We let them be children, we let them run wild, we let them do whatever they want to do, and as bad children, they behave incredibly badly, greedily, angrily, with hubris, and they perform really horrible activities around the world when we could be being parents and being in charge and being in charge of our dependence on this pretty deadly, bad resource for as long as we need to be dependent on it, taking responsibility for our dependence, and doing everything we can to move away from this resource actively, aggressively, and everything we can in our power to move away from it. And in going about doing this work, I have found that books are a very important contribution to understanding and spending some investigative time researching and writing on and reporting the activities of this industry. But there's at least this one book I really never thought I was going to write and wished I didn't have to write, which was the Gulf oil disaster. And in the wake of the disaster, I was actually in Houston for Chevron's annual shareholder meeting. Chevron had moved the meeting. They're based in California. They'd moved it to Houston to try to run away from us because they knew we were organizing around their meeting. And they went to Houston, and we followed them. They didn't get very far. And we had people from all over the world, from Chevron impacted communities there in Houston, from Angola, from Nigeria, from Australia, from the tar sands of Canada, from Ecuador, all over. And a number of us following the shareholder meeting went with our allies down to the Gulf Coast. This was just a couple weeks after the explosion, which was April 20th, 2010. And what we realized very early on was that one, even as people who researched, knew about, had studied, had written about, it lived the oil industry, even we were utterly caught off guard by how utterly caught off guard the oil industry was by this disaster. While they had pledged, written, guaranteed that they could handle a deep water blowout, that they could handle an oil spill of 300,000 barrels a day, what we found out was that they had no clue, none of them, what to do in the case of a deep water oil blowout. No clue whatsoever. Nor could they handle what turned out to be an oil spill that at its worst was a mere 80,000 barrels of oil a day, less than a third of what they said they could handle. They hadn't done the research. They didn't have the technology. They didn't have the boom. They didn't have the skim. And this ended up being the equivalent of one Exxon Valdez oil disaster every 4 days for 87 long days. For 87 long days, Exxon, Chevron, BP, Shell, ConocoPhillips sat around a table trying to figure out what to do. They had been told after the Valdez, they had been required to put some research into this little thing that might happen, this little thing called an oil spill. In the case of the Valdez, only 14% of all the oil that was spilled was recovered. 14%. You can still walk on beaches and stick in the sand. You just walk on the sand. There's still oil there. There's still something called the Valdez crud, which is the cough and the sickness that the people who had to engage with the oil suffer from. And they were told, you couldn't clean up this mess. What are you going to do next time? You need to prepare. You need to research. You need to put in the technology. And they said, oh, yes, 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 yes. We are very concerned about oil spills. Yes, 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 yes. The Gulf oil disaster happens. And they turn around and they said, oh, geez, yeah, turns out, yeah, we pretty much just have the same chemical. Yeah, we pretty much just have the same boom. Yeah, yeah, no, we really didn't prepare any containment ships. Yeah, no, we really haven't done anything. And so they just applied the exact same technology 20 years later to a disaster far worse. So when we were down in the Gulf, this was becoming clear. And that this was going to be something very, very, very serious. And I decided at that point that I needed to write a book on this and that I needed to spend as much time as possible with those communities most impacted by this disaster. And what I started to learn by interviewing oil workers, oil executives, fishers, environmentalists, community activists, you name it, the king and queen of the Shrimp and Petroleum Festival of Morgan City, Louisiana, was that there is no separating in the Gulf Coast the water or the environment from the people and the communities. There isn't economic impacts over here, human impacts, water, fish, environment. There's no separation. These are all part and parcel of the exact same experience. And the death that was coming to the ocean was coming to the shore. And the death that was coming to the shore was spreading to the ocean. And both of that continues, such that this oil disaster is a cultural disaster, it's an economic disaster, it's a livelihoods disaster, and it is an ecological disaster. And none of it had to happen. So, first of all, they didn't have to be out there, but let's just take for granted that they were out there. The failures that led to this disaster would be almost comical had they not killed 11 men and caused what is the largest oil spill in world history, and there's only one exception. Does anyone know what the largest oil spill in world history is? So, Ben, you don't get to answer. Derek's baby's here. Saddam Hussein, first Gulf War. So Saddam Hussein literally used oil as a weapon, intentionally released the pipelines and tankers of oil, and attacked U.S. and British soldiers with oil. That is the largest oil spill in world history. This is the company that BP and Transocean and Halliburton and the other companies responsible are keeping. Had it not been for Saddam Hussein, this would be hands down, no comparison, the largest oil spill in world history. And there's a number, I go in to great detail to the causes. But one of the lessons learned was that, so BP is the manager of this rig, the Deepwater Horizon, but the owner and operator is Transocean. And Transocean is the largest owner and operator of deepwater rigs in the world. They work with every major oil company. They are everywhere. And if you are at all concerned about what took place with the Deepwater Horizon, you need to be deeply concerned about Transocean. And if you're deeply concerned about Transocean, you need to be deeply concerned about offshore drilling exploration as well, anywhere, including here. Because the problems that were identified on this Transocean rig are in the hundreds of maintenance issues, upkeep issues, but most critically, the key components of this rig just simply weren't being taken care of. And when we're talking about these are the wealthiest companies literally the world has ever known. There is no financial comparison. They have more money than anyone's ever had. And yet, to the interview, every interview I conducted with oil workers, with executives, with engineers, they would all say, you know, if they can save $2 million here, $3 million there, $5 million there, they all do it. They'll do it. They'll cut corners. They'll speed up the pace. And the way that this rig was being operated, it was like, it was some guy's gas station around the corner. But this was a rig that was operating offshore. It's on the water. 5,000 feet below it is the ocean floor, and the drilling is 13,500 feet below that. That's not even close to the deepest well. Just a little bit past it was recently the deepest well. This was the Tiber field that BP was also operating, and the Deepwater Horizon also drilled. And that is 40,000 feet down. That's deeper, farther down than Mount Everest is up. And you assume that when they're doing this type of work, you know, they're taking it pretty darn seriously, right? This is enormous amounts of oil, incredibly complex, incredibly technologically profound and difficult. The reality is that they are doing it virtually unregulated, and they are doing it to, you know, shock, make as much money as they can, cut corners where they can, speed up production where they can. And they're doing it, this is part of the sort of bottom line, in advance of actually their technological willingness and know-how to do it right. And they're being pushed out that far, and 5,000 feet isn't even deep anymore. They're doing it 6,000 feet, 7,000 feet, 8,000 feet. And that's just the distance, remember, from the ocean to the floor. Then it's well deeper below that. Because that's where the oil is. That's why they want to go out into the Canadian Arctic. Because there's oil there. And as long as there's oil there, you need to be worried about them wanting to go there. Because they will go there even though they don't know how to do it. Because the way that they make money, here's another shock, isn't through wind and solar and algae, even though their commercials make you think that that's the way they make their money. Or that they see the writing on the wall that if they want to make their money in the future, they should be doing that. I'm sorry to burst your bubble. That's actually not how they make their money. It turns out they're oil companies. And the way that they make their money is by booking oil reserves and calling it theirs, and by producing oil. So they will go where the oil is. It turns out that this is one mode of production that they actually really don't know how to do. But they're doing it anyway and being allowed to do it anyway. They also aren't doing it carefully. So just a couple of the things that went wrong on this rig. And I take this very personally because I interviewed several of the family members of the young men who died aboard that rig, men who sacrificed their lives so that they could save their friends and their brothers on that rig, and could have left the point of impact but didn't because they were trying to save the rest of the men and the few women on that rig. And they tried to do several things that should have worked. They pressed a button. It's supposed to lock in the blowout preventer, which is the last line of defense on a rig, and they press the button and nothing happened. And then the people on the rig pressed a button that's supposed to disconnect the rig from the pipeline that ties it down to the hole, and they pressed that button and nothing happened. And it turned out that the blowout preventer is supposed to be checked every 5 years, but doing that means that you have to bring the rig in, and it'll take about 4 months away, and you'll lose money. Well, it'd been 10 years, and the blowout preventer had never been taken in. What people knew on the rig, though, is that there's at least two things wrong with the blowout preventer. One, really complicated things, like it was low on batteries, but they couldn't be bothered to make sure the batteries were up to date. And it was leaking hydraulic fluid, but they couldn't be bothered to make sure the hydraulic fluid worked. And so when this last line of defense was supposed to kick in, well, the batteries didn't work, so it didn't. And when the rig was supposed to be separated from the pipe that was tethering it to this exploding hole, it couldn't because it didn't have batteries. So what happened was there was these explosions, and fortunately, while 11 men died trying to protect the rig, 115 survived, and they got off the rig. But then we found out another thing, which is that not only are we not regulating the deep water operations, and not only do they not really know how to do them very well, but we have no regulations on what to do if there's a fire out there. So there's a fire on a rig. It's a rig that's sitting on 50 million barrels of oil and gas, and it's exploding. But there's no plan for a fire. So good Samaritans show up, and they spray water on the rig, but it turns out that this rig is supported by these floating pontoons. And what you're really supposed to do is spray this foam. But nobody told the good Samaritans that. So the pontoons filled with water, and then the rig collapsed. And when the rig collapsed is when we went from having what could have just been a spill, death, but a rig saved. We had a collapsing rig that when it fell off, the pipeline connecting it to the well kinked over and snapped. But there's a reason why I don't call this an oil gusher, and lots of people do. Isn't because I have a soft spot for BP, the rig lessee, or for Transocean, or for Halliburton, which did the crappy cement job, or for Cameron, which made the blowout preventer, but rather because we got lucky. When the rig capsized, it could have dislodged the pipe out of the hole, in which case we would have had a gusher. Instead, all that happened was that the pipe kinked in three places, and we had leaks from the kinks. Those leaks leaked the largest oil spill in world history, unintentional oil spill in world history. What we could have had was an uncontrollable gusher. There's no reason to believe we're going to get lucky in the future. The next thing that happened was the oil industry had no idea how to deal with a deep water blowout, which is horrific and shocking and disgusting. They tried to apply shallow water technology. Shallow rigs operate at 30 feet, 40 feet, 400 feet. This is 5,000 feet of water. They were trying to apply shallow water technology into the deep water. Guess what? It didn't work. They also didn't have containment ships. So if you saw any of the imagery, there was these burns on the surface of the ocean. It looked like Armageddon, literally burning oil on the surface of the ocean, these dark black billowing clouds. They burned the oil because they were able to corral some of it and boom. But they didn't have ships ready to suck it up. So they had it sitting there, and they had nowhere to put it. So they burned it on the surface of the ocean, creating a toxic aerosol. They then didn't have the underwater vehicles they needed to repair the damage below. They didn't have any new technologies, I said, for boom or skim. And they also had just the same old chemical Corexit. And what happened was that they took this toxic chemical Corexit and basically applied it with mass application and added what the theory was, we want to sacrifice the ocean for the shore. Oil is toxic. You don't want people coming into contact with it. It's a bad deal. You don't want it coming to shore. So one of the reasons why you apply the dispersant is to spread it out in the ocean. And you sacrifice the ocean for the shore. And there's some logic to that, right? I don't want people coming into contact with oil. I don't want it coming to the beach. However, this was so much oil. And then they applied so much chemical dispersant, 2 million gallons of chemical dispersant, toxic chemical dispersant, that what you had was you sacrificed the ocean and the shore. Because the oil did reach the shore, but it also reached the shore with the chemical as well. And so then you had a toxic oil chemical stew. What you also have now still to this day, so the oil went to shore, it got dispersed throughout the water column. What it also did unpredictably was to sink to the bottom of the ocean. Now, oil is lighter than water, it's supposed to float. It was sinking, it was being suspended mid-water in plumes, these giant plumes, and it was sinking to the bottom of the ocean. The question was to figure out why. The oil was being suspended in the water in these huge giant plumes because of the gas. The oil was mixing with gas and creating a cloud. and that was suspending oil through the water column. But then oil was also traveling to the bottom. Now, this is important because one of the lovely little myths about the Gulf oil disaster is that there were the mighty microbes that ate the oil, right? Everyone heard that? So everything was fine because these natural little microbes got out there and they were chomping on the oil and the oil's all gone. So don't worry about oil spills because nature will take care of it. Well, it's a lovely, lovely fantasy. Unfortunately, while there are microbes that do eat oil, which is kind of cool, what they normally eat, so if you think of the natural oil seepage that occurs, the amount of oil that naturally seeps in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, and this is the ninth largest body of water in the world, it's huge, over the expanse of the entire Gulf of Mexico, for an entire year, you get the amount of oil that is the equivalent to 30 minutes of 1 hour of 1 day of the Gulf oil disaster. That's how much naturally seeps. So the microbes were working. They were eating. They were doing a really good job. They couldn't come close to challenging this mass, and we wouldn't want them to, because there's two facts about the microbes. One is when they eat, they use oxygen. When they use oxygen, they deplete it for everything else that lives on the oxygen. So you've got all these microbes eating, and they're also basically eating oxygen out of the water, which means that everything else that depends on the oxygen has nothing to live on. The other issue was what my lovely friend who I write about in the book, Dr. Samantha Joy, who's an amazing character, CNN compared her to the librarian version of Angelina Jolie, and that works. What she called the microbial snot highway. So when the microbes eat, they excrete. And when they excrete, the excretion trails down and it looks like snot. And the snot carries the oil down, and it creates a highway by which the oil went down to the bottom of the ocean. There it mixes with sand, and there it stays. Also, the plumes mix with sand and carry the oil down, and they stay. Also, the soot from the fires carried the oil down, and it stayed. And what Dr. Joy has traced on the bottom of the ocean of the Gulf of Mexico, at least 80 miles, if not much farther out from the spill site, is a 2-inch thick layer of oil that's sitting on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico with a layer of chemical dispersant on top of it. We are in hurricane season, just started. When the hurricanes come, they regularly bring 6 feet of mud onto land. That's normal. I mean modern normal, the new climate change normal. So now, what's going to be in the mud? Oil, toxic. Corexit, toxic. The two combined, worse than the two separate. And where's it going to sit? It's going to sit in places like in Jamie Beaulieu, who I interview, of the United Homa Nation, a community that lives what's on called Louisiana's fingers. These have become fingers because of coastal erosion. It's more like the leprosy of Louisiana. Where Jamie lives, her tribe has lived for hundreds of years, but they are moving away with each storm. It's harder and harder to stay. When that mud comes in, and it's toxic, and they already can't fish, who's going to stay? And will the United Homa Nation be wiped out of its ancestral home? And then the fishers. So what isn't at the bottom of the ocean that is supposed to be there is the life that is supposed to reside on the bottom of the ocean. The worms, the algae, the oysters, the shrimp. The oil came in and killed the two primary economic drivers of the Gulf Coast region, fisheries and tourism. And so there's been a desperate push to say, oh, the fisheries are fine, the tourism's fine, the beaches are fine. Neither of which is true, but you can understand the impulse to say so because these are the only two economic drivers left. The reality is that the fisheries are not okay, the beaches are not okay. And BP has not lived up to its financial or moral or legal obligations in the Gulf Coast. It is fighting tooth and nail every step of the way. And it is fighting on the things that we think it's doing a good job on. So there's all sorts of, you know, talk about, oh, you know, this bill is good and it's better than others because BP, you know, it's the United States. So BP was forced to pay $20 billion, right? Everyone's heard that, right? It's in the United States. Like, you know, it's a whole other thing. You have a spill there and the company has to chalk up, you know, $20 billion. Well, that would be nice in theory. It's just not true. So there was a pledge to put up $20 billion if it was needed. BP's put up $4 billion and they've paid out $4 billion in claims. That's about a third of what's been filed. What BP is arguing on everything else is that they don't owe any more money, basically. So on just one area where they should owe money, under the Clean Water Act in the United States, oil company, if they're found that they acted with negligence, is responsible for $4,300 per barrel of oil spilled. That would end up being $20 billion just for the oil spilled. What BP is arguing is that they shouldn't have to pay a per barrel rate. They should pay a day rate, and that day rate averages out to a total of $3 million for the entire oil spill. That's three with an M, 3 million, instead of 20 billion with a B, billion. And basically, you know, as they would, they are in fact fighting tooth and nail. And in the United States, where it's supposed to be so easy to take on an oil spill, we have not passed a single piece of legislation in the wake of this disaster, not one. Everything is tied up in litigation. The claims process that we put in place after we passed the Oil Pollution Act after the Exxon Valdez has not served its function and gotten money to those who most need it. And even we have had an incredibly difficult time dealing with what should have been an easy, quote unquote, easy issue to deal with because there was so much attention paid on it, right? But the oil industry has outfoxed us thus far. They put in place a very powerful agenda, which was to isolate BP and make this incident seem like a fluke. Neither of which, whether you look at the Presidential Commission on the Oil Spill, the Coast Guard Commission on the Oil Spill, the Interior Department, me, the Deepwater Horizon Study Group, anyone, everyone will tell you this was the outcome of systemic problems across the entire industry and emblematic of those problems. And that this is not remotely an issue isolated to BP and not remotely an issue that was a fluke, that it was predictable and BP just got there first. So here's the good news, and here's where I will end. As I record throughout this book is not a depressing book. This is a book of heroism. There are incredible activists and organizers all across the Gulf Coast that are working to make sure that the Gulf Coast survives, but also to change government policy in the United States and internationally, to respond to this crisis by helping the Gulf Coast, but also by learning from it and saying we actually can rein in this industry, restrict where it operates, regulate it, and we can make sure that it doesn't happen anywhere else again, and that there are people doing this work internationally, nationally, and in the Gulf Coast, but they need their voices to be heard. They need the story of the Gulf oil spill to continue to be told, and they need it to be told as a current problem, not something that happened back then, back there in the past, and that it is a cautionary, cautionary tale. There's no reason to believe that this can't and won't happen somewhere else. And when I went to BP's annual shareholder meeting, I went with a statement, and that statement was written by Keith Jones, the father of Gordon Jones, whose son, 28 years old, died aboard the Deepwater Horizon. Gordon was 28. His wife was 1 week away from giving birth to his second son, Gordon Maxwell. His older son was 2 years old, had just celebrated his second birthday. And Gordon died because the person who was supposed to relieve him looked tired, and Gordon said, you know, Leo, go back to bed. Yeah, I'll take this watch. I got it. And he died the way he lived. And Keith said in the statement that it was greed that killed his son, that BP was rolling the dice with his son's life, and that BP lost. But Keith is going to make sure that that never happens again, and that it's our job to make sure that Gordon's memory and his father's commitment to making sure that no other son suffers his son's consequence lives on. So thank you for helping me do that, and thank you for being here tonight.